Our scripture reading this morning comes from Luke 24, verses 1 through 12. You can find it printed in your bulletin this morning. But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they went to the tomb, taking the spices they had prepared. And they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they went in, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men stood by them in dazzling apparel. And as they were frightened and bowed their faces to the ground, the men said to them, "Why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here, but has risen. Remember how he told you, while he was still in Galilee, that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise." And they remembered his words. And returning from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and the other women with them who told these things to the apostles. But these words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them. But Peter rose and ran to the tomb. Stooping and looking in, he saw the linen cloths by themselves, and he went home marveling at what had happened. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Somewhere around the year 1900, there was invented an idea about the resurrection of Christ, which actually had not really ever appeared before in the previous 1900 years of the church's history. It caught on in that year and has actually become quite commonplace in the way in which the resurrection is frequently taught in Bible colleges, seminaries, and divinity schools, and therefore what is actually taught quite frequently in the pulpits of many churches in the world today. It is this idea, stated simply, if I may. It does not matter whether the resurrection of Jesus Christ actually happened historically. It does not matter, because what is truly important is whether or not you have a resurrection event in your heart every day. Now, at first, when you hear that, that sounds pretty good. I mean, after all, isn't it important that I have a resurrection event in my heart every day? Isn't it important that I believe in Jesus every day and that I know the power of Christ every day, that something of the resurrection strength and meaning and power comes to me every day? Is that not important? Yes. The question is whether it means anything more than a fairy tale, or, as it is said in this text, is it anything more than an idle tale? When I was in seminary in my mid-20s, my mom and my dad were not believers. In fact, I have told some of you this story. I never once saw my parents in church until I was 27 years old. Never once. And my 25-year-old my 25-year-old sister was being married. I was 27, she was 25, she was being married, my parents came to church. But when I was in seminary during those years, my father was very curious. He himself was the son of a Roman Catholic gentleman and a Jewish lady who had married in 1910 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In a marriage that in those days was absolutely unheard of. And they both were defellowshipped from their respective congregations for the next 25 years because of it. During which time they had four sons, my father being the third. They used to take walks with their sons on Saturday and Sunday afternoon to teach them about all faiths. They took a walk in a place called Shenley Park in Pittsburgh, if you know it. That is not a method of religious education that I can endorse, because, in fact, all four boys became nominally, and I do mean very nominally, Protestant when they married nominally Protestant women, my mom being one of them. And I do thank the Lord that by the end of their lives, both of my parents had indeed become Christians. But at that time, my father was not only skeptical, he was a little bit tongue-in-the-cheek about it all. And so when I came home from seminary one time for vacation, and he said, "Well, what are you studying in that seminary school, boy?" I told him what I just told you about the different theories of the resurrection, and I told him that some people believed that it didn't matter if the resurrection happened historically. All that mattered was that there was a resurrection event in our heart every day. And do you know what my father said? My father, who was not a believer, he looked at me and he said, "Skip, that is Easter Bunny Christianity. That makes no sense at all." And he was right, even as an unbeliever. In chapter 24, verse 7, it says here that the Son of Man must be delivered, must be crucified, must rise. Why is the must there? Why must these things happen, actually happen in history? Why can't they just happen like flowers sprouting in our garden in the springtime, new breaths of life coming upon us, new Easter lilies of smell and beauty? Why can't the resurrection be like that? Why, in fact, is the resurrection not like that at all? When I was in Charlottesville, Virginia for over 17 years, there was a man who was associate professor of the law school at the University of Virginia, where my wife studied. His name was Lane Needler, and he wouldn't mind my using his name because he's actually very happy about this. For many years, he came to a kind of inquirer's Bible study that I was leading, and he never could cross the line to believe in Jesus Christ. Not really believe. I mean, he sort of believed he was a man. He believed he lived. He might even have believed he died. But the resurrection? Oh, no. I can't believe that. I will not, I cannot believe the resurrection. He said, "There's too much evidence against it." And I said to Lane, "Let me ask you this, Lane. If I could prove to you that the resurrection historically happened, would that compel your faith?" Now, I want you to remember that question and hold on to it for the next few minutes. It's a very important question. It's the question of the morning. If I can compel you by the historical evidence to believe in the historicity of the resurrection, then would you believe it? And Lane said, "Yes, I would." And so we discussed about a lot of things. We talked about the specificity of the resurrection accounts. They happened on a specific day of the week. They happened on the first day of the week. They even happened at a particular time of day, at dawn. There's a specific description of the men, probably angels, the clothing that they were wearing. There's specific women involved. Verse 10, Mary of Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, other women. Women, by the way, were not considered reliable witnesses in the first century. So that's interesting that Luke would give women the place of prominence in accounting for the historical veracity of the resurrection. Why does he do that? Well, he does it because the resurrection was so accepted by the time he wrote his gospel that it didn't matter that it was women who were the first people who saw it. It was so well known that he lost nothing in his argument by making the women the first of those who observed it. Author Lee Strobel has written a book who has said that he and a bunch of other lawyers, a group of lawyers, attempted to prove that the resurrection could not take place. And they spent a few years attempting to do so. And the book they wrote was just the opposite in the end. It was a book that demonstrated that the resurrection did happen historically, because the more and more they discovered the evidence, this is what they found. When I was 24 years old, I'd been a Christian 8 years. I'd become a Christian like many young teenagers, kind of following the crowd, sincerely believing. I've never doubted that I was a Christian from that point on. But when I was 24 years old, I had a lot of questions. Is the Bible true? Did the resurrection really happen? Is this all what Francis Schaeffer in those days used to call true truth? Could I really believe it? Well, being 24, being single, and not having many responsibilities, I took 6 months off. I went to a place called Le Brie in Switzerland, and I studied for 6 months, and I pretended that I was not a Christian. I actually portrayed myself as one who is not a believer in order that I would start from scratch and see if I could be persuaded. Some of the things that I learned are fascinating, and I will share them, not all of them by any means, and just briefly with you. Philip Schaff, a famous church historian, says the resurrection of Jesus Christ is therefore emphatically a test question upon which depends the truth or falsehood of the Christian religion. It is either the greatest miracle or the greatest delusion that history ever records. And another historian by the name of John Warwick Montgomery says this: note that when the disciples of Jesus proclaimed the resurrection, they did so as eyewitnesses, and they did so while people were still alive who had been in contact with the events they spoke of. In 56 AD, Paul wrote that over 500 people had seen the risen Christ, and that most of them were still alive. It passes the bounds of credibility that the early Christians could have manufactured such a tale and preached it among those who might easily have refuted it simply by doing one thing. What was that one thing? What was the only thing they had to do to produce a foolproof refutation of the resurrection? They just had to show the body. And they couldn't do it. John R.W. Stott said that the silence of Christ's enemies is as eloquent as the proof of the apostles. Isn't that interesting? They couldn't say anything. Each of the disciples, except John, died a martyr's death. A martyr's death. They were persecuted because they tenaciously clung to their beliefs and their conviction about the resurrection. Men will die for what they believe to be true, even if it proves to be false. But men will not die for what they do not believe to be true. So whatever you must say that not only the 12, but the 500 and the 3,000 in Jerusalem right after Pentecost, you must say they found no body. They believed in this resurrection, whatever else you may or may not say about it. Some people think there's something called the swoon theory. In other words, that Jesus never really died. Have you ever heard of that? He never really died. He was put in the tomb. He was weakened, of course, by the cross. And I could go into so much detail about the nature of the cross, as Bill Lamberth did so accurately the other day in one of our Holy Week services, that would demonstrate that this is absolutely impossible that he was not dead. But just assume, just pretend that he was not quite dead. Can you imagine the not quite dead Jesus after flogging and crucifixion, 36 hours in a stone sepulcher without warmth, without many medical care, without food or water, could rally to perform superhuman feats of shifting the boulder which blocked the door to the tomb, and that he could do this without disturbing the Roman guards set there to watch over him. And then, weak and sickly and hungry, he could appear to the disciples in such a way to give them the impression that he had not only died, but that he had risen not to life, but to vibrant new life, strong new life, life strong enough to lead a movement that within 300 years had captured the entire civilized world with its truth and veracity. Some people say, well, there were people who saw hallucinations. It's interesting, you know, only particular kinds of people see hallucinations. You and I know who they are. They're wackos. There are people who really don't see things straight. They're psychologically weak people. The problem, not everybody who saw Christ risen from the dead was a wacko. Not everybody was prone to believe such a thing. In fact, the truth is that disciples were, as we have indicated in this account, actually prone to believe what? That he was dead. Their first reaction was that he was dead. The disciples were not gullible. They were cautious, skeptical, slow of heart to believe. They were not susceptible to hallucinations. They would not have strange visions, and only hard facts would persuade them. Here's a summary statement by a professor of law from Harvard Law School, a man named Simon Greenleaf. All that Christianity asks of men is that they would be consistent with themselves, that they would treat its evidence as if they treat the evidence of any other thing, and that they would try and judge its actors and its witnesses as they deal with their fellow men when testifying to human affairs and actions in human tribunals. Let the witnesses be compared with themselves, with each other, and with surrounding facts and circumstances. Let their testimonies be sifted as if they were giving a court account of their eyewitness. Let the witnesses be subject to rigorous cross-examination. The result, it is confidently believed, will undoubtedly be the conviction of their integrity, ability, and truthfulness. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is a question of history. If it did not happen, then to quote the Apostle Paul, you and I are the most foolish of people to even be here this morning. We ought to laugh at ourselves and get out of here. But secondly, and more importantly, the resurrection is not only a question of history, it is a question of heart. Some would say, okay, the resurrection happened. Okay, Jesus rose from the dead. Strange things happen. It's a strange world. It's a kooky world. I've heard of resurrections in Indonesia. Odd things happen. Big deal. Let me put it to you this way. The resurrection is not less than historical, but it is more than historical. In other words, the way you perceive it will determine what you believe about it. You not only have to be sufficiently demonstrated that it is historically true, but the perception, the mindset that you have about it must be one that gives you an openness to it. Perception, as they say, is everything. There's a story that came out of an East Long Island newspaper a few months ago. A boat captain sent a message out to sea in a bottle, and he received a reply from a Brit several months later. The plastic bottle was one that he had put in an ocean off of New York's Long Island in late August, and then he later in the spring, that next spring, he excitedly opened a letter from England and was stunned by the reply. "My dear Mr. Bennett," it said, "I recently found your bottle while taking a scenic walk on the beach by Poole Harbor," which is in the south of England. "While you may consider this some profound experiment on the path and speed of oceanic currents, I have another name for it. Litter. You Americans don't seem to be happy unless you are mucking about somewhere." And it was signed Henry Bigglesworth of Bournemouth in Dorset County. Perception is everything. Hearing is an inference. For one man, it was a great idea to send a bottle across the ocean with a message in it. For another man, it was trash and litter. And that is the same about the resurrection. For one person, it is the most fabulous message that could be put in a bottle, a book, or in a human mouth. And for others, it is simply religious litter. It makes all the difference what you say it is. The resurrection that was heard by 10 of the 11 remaining apostles, not Peter, but 10 of the 11, they heard it from these women. And these women said, they said themselves, that this was an event that frightened them and caused them to bow their faces to the ground. And when they reported it to the disciples, all but Peter, said, "It is an idle tale." An idle tale. And the question is whether you and I think the same. The evidence of the resurrection is important, but the evidence are the small guns under the big guns. In theology, we call this the presuppositions. Your presuppositions, your inferences that you draw, your mindset that is prone or not prone to believe the evidence, will interpret the evidence no matter how foolproof it is. And so the issue we must deal with is not only the historical veracity of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but the issue we must deal with is your heart and whether your heart and my heart see this story as idle, an idle tale, or whether we see it as the truth. In Luke 22, just a couple of chapters earlier, Jesus is before the council of the elders. And it says there in Luke 22, if I may just get to it for a moment, please. Luke 22, verse 66. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both the chief priests and the scribes. And they led him away to their council, and they said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe." Isn't that interesting? You see, Jesus knew that the real issue wasn't the arguments that he could mount for the resurrection. The real issue was whether or not their hearts were prone to believe. In John chapter 8, verse 25, we read this. So they said to him, "Who are you?" And Jesus said to them, "Just what I have been telling you from the beginning. I have much to say to you and much to judge, but he who sent me is true, and I declare to the world what I have heard from him." They did not understand. Understanding is a matter of inference. Belief is a matter of the disposition of your heart. It is something over which we are slightly out of control, and therefore it is scarier to us than the evidences. The evidences we can at least analyze, and we can figure out with our minds whether we believe them or not. And some of us, like Lane Needler, can become Christians when they become convinced that the evidences are true. But what I said to Lane after he became a Christian is, you have not become a Christian because the evidences have been proven to you. You have become a Christian because the short little guns of evidences have opened up your heart to the big guns. And the big guns are the Spirit of God that will convince you of the truth as you hear it proclaimed in your ears and in your heart. The resurrection is always to be proclaimed. Sometimes people will not understand. Mark 15, the chief priests accuse him of many things, and Pilate asked him, "Have you no answer to make?" But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Why? Why did he make no further answer? Because he knew it didn't matter to them. They were prone to believe or not believe.
according to the work that was at taking place in their own hearts as they hear the message. And you and I are prone to believe or not believe according to the work that God is doing in our hearts right now as we believe or we don't believe. At other times, contrary to these times when Jesus said very little or nothing, he seemed to almost be very wasteful and lavish in the way he would speak about the gospel. He gives the parable of the power of the sower who sows the seed everywhere. If you're a farmer, you prepare the soil very carefully in rows, right? And then you lay the seed very carefully in those rows and you cultivate those rows and help nurture it along. That's not what he did. He threw the seed everywhere. Some of it landed on hard and barren, rocky soil. Some was picked up by the birds. Some was crowded out by thorns and weeds, and some landed on good soil. There is a lavishness to the way we preach and speak of the resurrection of Christ, because frankly, I do not know what is going on in your heart. So I throw it out there. And yes, I give you evidence, but I call you to faith as I do this morning. I call you to believe this is the truth of truths. I call you to understand that there could never be a truth like this truth. One time, Jesus is before the Pharisees, and he says, after he gives the parable of the sower, "This is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand." And then he goes on to quote Isaiah, who says, "You will indeed hear, but never understand. You will indeed see, but never perceive. For this people's hearts have grown dull." That's it. That's it, my friends. Has your heart grown dull? Have you heard it all your life? Have you been to Sunday school since you were 2? Have you walked the sawdust trail at Bible camp when you were 7? Have you gone to Young Life camp when you were 16? Have you joined the church when you were 20? Have you baptized your babies when you're 30? You've heard it all. You've heard it all. But it isn't in your heart. It isn't there. It hasn't been grounded there. It's on rocky soil or soil with thorns and thistles of the cares of this world growing up all around it. Or the birds pluck the seed away and do not let life grow there. The difference, my friends, is between knowledge and knowing. You can be convinced that the resurrection is true here by the evidences and still not have it change your life. Jesus says there is more to hearing than listening. And after the parable of the sower, he quotes from the prophet Isaiah, as I just said to you. And the question that must be asked is, what makes our hearts dull? And in the context of this passage, I will tell you what makes our hearts dull. Idle tales. Tales that we just hear again and again, but don't really change us. Look, follow me here. I'm almost done, but this is worth it. In all of Western literature, there is one plot. One basic plot in all of Western literature. It goes something like this. Things are going along well. Then there's an introduction of a problem, a mystery. Then the problem or the mystery becomes a crisis. And then there enters a figure who resolves the crisis either well or not so well. The first kind of person who resolves a crisis well is called a hero. The second kind of figure who resolves the crisis poorly is called a tragic figure because despite his giftedness, he has serious flaws. In classical literature, Roman and Greek and Jewish literature, it was either a hero or a tragic hero. Sometimes it was one, sometimes the other. In modern literature, what is it? Modern literature, like the 50s, 60s, 70s, almost always a hero. It always turns out right. The good guy in the end rides off in the sunset with a beautiful girl on his horse. But in postmodern literature, the plays, and especially the movies that we're seeing today, it always ends poorly. And the tragic hero is the one who is left in the end. My friends, the question is whether you consider this an idle tale, or whether you do what the women did. When the women came to the tomb and they saw it was empty, what did they do? They bowed their faces to the ground, it says. That is precisely the same term, bowed, that is used of Jesus in John's gospel when it says, he bowed his head and breathed the last on the cross. In both cases, it was done as an act of volitional will. Jesus bowed his head. Jesus gave up his life. And the women volitionally believed that he was no longer in that tomb. And they bowed their faces to the ground. What about you? Is this an idle tale? Or does this story, this narrative, this truth cause you to bow your face to the ground? Do you remember the movie Castaway? Some of you have seen it. I won't explain the whole movie. You know it. Man is separated for 4 years from civilization. He's a FedEx guy. His FedEx plane crashes. He ends up on a remote Pacific island. He's lost. They thought he's dead. His wife ends up marrying somebody else. I guess it was his wife or his fiance ends up marrying somebody else in the meantime. And then he comes back. And the only thing he has with him is one of the FedEx boxes that he had when the plane crashed. And he decided, as an act of completing the meaning of this terrible 4-year journey, he would return that FedEx box. Do you remember where it came from? A ranch in West Texas. And do you remember the end of the movie? He's deciding whether he's going to go. He goes to the ranch, and the person isn't there. And he drives away, and he's driving away. A pickup truck passes him. On the back of the pickup truck, he notices the same symbol for the ranch that's on the return address symbol of the FedEx box. So he knows it belongs to the person in the pickup truck, who stops, backs up, and is a very beautiful lady, and says, "Are you lost, cowboy?" And he says, "No, I don't think so." And she drives on. And the movie ends with him standing in the intersection of these two farm roads in West Texas, just standing there. And we don't know whether he's going to go back to her and return the FedEx box and presumably start a new life or not. That's where many of you are. You're at the crossroads. You're either going to say this is an idle tale, or you're going to bow your face to the ground and say, this is the narrative of my life. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.